From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
A new look for politics and new leadership at the Pentagon. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. On the day after Democrats won control of the Congress, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld steps down. Former CIA Director Robert Gates is named to replace him. Nancy Pelosi will be the new House Speaker, but the Senate majority may not be known before Christmas. A lot of questions on To the Point. President Bush and Speaker-elect Pelosi pledge bipartisanship, but what about their differences on the war in Iraq? Just who is Nancy Pelosi? Will there be recounts for Senate seats in Virginia and in Montana? Whatever happened to the permanent Republican majority? Can Democrats maintain power without the South? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco will be the next speaker of a Congress controlled by Democrats. The Senate is still too close to call. On To the Point, we'll look at yesterday's voting, the prospect for recounts, and the politics of the immediate future. First, this news update. President Bush has accepted Donald Rumsfeld's resignation as Secretary of Defense. His chosen replacement is former CIA Director Robert Gates. Mr. Bush was asked if that means a new direction.
Well, there's certainly going to be new leadership at the Pentagon, and as I mentioned in my comments, that Secretary Rumsfeld and I agreed that sometimes it's necessary to have a fresh perspective, and Bob Gates will bring a fresh perspective.
President Bush, a part of a long news conference he held today. David Sanger is White House correspondent for the New York Times. Always good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
Some big surprises.
Some very big ones. I mean, I think there was a lot of expectation that if Secretary Rumsfeld was going to leave, he would leave in this time period before the Baker-Hamilton report came out. But certainly we did not have any notice that the decision had been made.
The Baker-Hamilton report, you're talking about James Baker, former Secretary of State, and Lee
That's
Hamilton,
right.
A former congressman, a Democrat.
Who are out examining options on Iraq. And in some ways this makes things a little bit easier for the administration because you not only is Mr. Rumsfeld, somebody who is obviously very invested in the current Iraq policy, as is the president and the vice president, but Bob Gates, his nominee to be his successor, is a member of that commission.
Yeah, but Gates is on the commission. Will he resign from it, do you suppose, recuse himself while he goes before the Senate for confirmation?
I would assume so, but I don't know that.
Okay. Once again, the president kind of stole the moment, didn't he, after the Democrats won the election?
He did. It's a way for him to stay in the headlines and make it clear that, you know, he still is running Iraq policy and that while he heard the message of the election, he said that he also reemphasized, I think two or three times in the course of this, that he did not believe that you could simply up and leave.
Nancy Pelosi today, the Speaker-elect of the Congress, said that she and Senator Reid, should the Democrats take over the Senate, have sent a letter to the president saying what they want to see is disarmament of the militias, a change in the Constitution so that the Sunnis presumably get a better shake than they do now, regional diplomacy, and then redeployment of American troops. Is the Congress, even if it wins both houses, if the Democrats win both houses, mm-hmm. in a position to really do anything about that?
You know, unclear the degree to which they would be willing to do anything about that. We assume that the House would never take the step of cutting off funding, which is, you know, their ultimate weapon, but that would seem to be a move that would be aimed at the troops and would hurt the troops a lot. And I think the new leadership has been quite explicit in saying that that is not what they have in mind. So what they have in mind is a power of persuasion. But what's more important here, I believe, is that you're now seeing a lot of Republicans who have been critical of the policy who now feel less compelled to hold their tongues. And I think that's a significant change. In addition, several of them had called for Secretary Rumsfeld's resignation. this, or at least said that it would make things easier. This now takes that off the table. And Bob Gates is somebody who I think is well known enough to them from his time at the CIA that it's not like we're seeing an unknown, untested character come into this test.
We're going to hear more about Robert Gates in a few moments. In the meantime, the president said he had spoken with Speaker-elect Pelosi. She said she had spoken to him as well. She also repeated in her news conference that impeachment is simply not on the table. How did the president seem to be handling the defeat, which he said up to the last minute he didn't think was going to happen?
Yeah, I thought that he was remarkably forthright. He said at one point that taken together it amounted to a thumping. It was not an effort to sort of spin the outcome. But, you know, he also, I think, recognized that there would be something extraordinarily useful in being, you know, disarmingly candid about the nature of what had happened, especially since it was fairly obvious to all, especially to members of his own party.
On the other hand, it's been fairly obvious to all that things were not going well in Iraq, and he has steadfastly refused to admit that until very recently.
Yeah, and it'd be interesting to see if now that the election season is gone and, you know, his comments aren't necessarily being thrown back at him in a political context, whether he feels freer to acknowledge some of those setbacks. But I did think it was interesting that he, you know, repeatedly said some form of the word victory, and he has not backed off of that. Interesting question is whether we're going to see victory redefined.
Again, as always, the question becomes, what does victory mean when the president uses it and when Vice President Cheney uses it as well?
That's right.
David Sanger at the White House for The New York Times. Always good to hear from you. Again, big news today coming out of the Oval Office.
Well, thanks very much.
In a moment, we'll talk about the new leadership at the Pentagon, and particularly about Robert Gates, a former head of the CIA, now appointed by the president, still, of course, has to be confirmed by the Senate. What might his prospects be of getting Don Rumsfeld's old job? Later on, we'll talk about the prospects for divided government, with the Democrats very definitely taking over the House. A still real question about who's going to be in control of the Senate. All that on To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Once again, Donald Rumsfeld has resigned. The president has accepted his resignation. He said it was a mutual decision in order to bring new ideas into the Pentagon. He says the president does that will be accomplished if Robert Gates, former director of the CIA, is confirmed by the Senate as the replacement of Donald Rumsfeld as Secretary of Defense. Jeff Stein is national security editor for Congressional Quarterly. He also writes the weekly Spy Talk column. Jeff Stein, good to have you with us.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
What can you tell us about Robert Gates?
Well, it's a curious nomination in some ways because considering that the major political problem that the White House has had is the charges that they spun the intelligence, manipulated the intelligence on Iraq, Robert Gates was accused of basically the same thing during the 1980s when he was the head of analysis at the CIA, and the Reagan administration came in, and they saw the CIA as an enemy camp. That sounds familiar also, the way the Bush administration looked at the CIA and put Porter Goss out there for director. And the picture of Gates came up in the Soviet Union was much harder, a much harder picture of the Soviet Union as a power that would continue on. Well, in their analysis of 1988, Gates said that the Soviets would become mightier and mightier as time went by, and of course, 2 years later, the Soviets were gone. He was also pushing to make a connection between the Soviet Union and various revolutionary groups and encouraging them and arming them to carry out terrorist operations against U.S. and Western targets. And as a former analyst at the CIA testified during Gates' hearings to become CIA director, said they did not find that connection. They exhaustively researched that, and the picture was not that which Gates sought in the alternative analysis. That analysis was suppressed. So Gates has weathered this kind of testimony and criticism before. You can probably expect the Democrats to bring this up again in confirmation hearings. You can bet on it that they'll bring this up again, and that's going to reopen the not closed wounds of the Iraq intelligence question.
So, as you say, then, a curious nomination, given the history, all the more important who controls the Senate. Once again, we'll be talking about that a little bit later.
Yep.
We don't know yet exactly who that's going to be. It's going to be very close in any case, but it will certainly matter very much who's the chair of the committee when Robert Gates is, in fact, interrogated about his appropriateness as Secretary of Defense.
That's right. He's going to be asked a lot about that, no matter who's in charge of the committee.
What about the relationship between the CIA and the Pentagon? Is this the kind of appointment that's going to go down well, do you think, with the people over there?
Well, you'll have two people running CIA and the Pentagon. Oh. Who they're kind of switched hats. You've got Gates, who ran the CIA, going to be running the Pentagon, theoretically anyway, and you've got a former military guy who's running the CIA. That's Michael Hayden, and then you've got a former diplomat who's running the top intelligence body, which is the new Directorate of National Intelligence. So these guys know each other. They've known each other for a long time. So I expect they'll be pretty chummy, but that won't be a problem. In fact, I think that situation will improve. I think Rumsfeld was disparaging of CIA, viewed it as kind of an enemy camp, and that relationship should improve if Robert Gates becomes the head of the Pentagon.
Jeff Stein, again, writes the weekly Spy Talk column. He's also a national security editor for Congressional Quarterly. Joe Galloway is a nationally syndicated columnist. He was former military correspondent for the Knight Ridder newspapers, author of We Were Soldiers Once and Young. Joe Galloway, good to have you with us.
Hey, good to be back, Warren.
You have been a staunch critic of Secretary Rumsfeld. What do you think about his resignation?
Well, I think it was to be expected, given the outcome of the election. You know, no more free rides in Congress. I'm assuming a lot of investigative committee work is ahead, a lot of subpoenas, and so it's the right decision for Bush to make now, and it would have been the right decision for him to make when I first called for it 3 years ago.
You called for it, and increasingly more and more officers, some of them very high-ranking officers, retired officers in the Pentagon, began calling for his resignation. How do you think they're going to react to new leadership?
Well, I think if you were standing within 10 miles of the Pentagon when this was announced, you could have heard a sigh of relief collectively. The guy needed to go. He ran an autocratic Pentagon. It was his way or the highway, and the military leadership not quite used to that. They kind of have, you know, most of them 30, 35 years in a uniform and have been to a goat rope or two and a war or two, and they have ideas and suggestions, none of which were welcome during Rumsfeld's reign. So I'm not surprised by any of it, and I'm delighted that it finally came to pass.
How are they going to feel about a CIA veteran, a former director, and one who, as Jeff Stein just told us, was in fact accused of spinning intelligence and was demonstrably and rather publicly wrong about how long the Soviet Union was going to last?
Well, this remains to be seen. The relief of Rumsfeld's departure is palpable, and there has to be some uncertainty about Mr. Gates. If there is a positive note on the appointment of Gates, it would be that he is far more closely aligned to George W. Bush's father, and the president has not, over the last 6 years, seemingly taken much, if any, advice from his father, who had a bit more experience with international affairs than Junior did. So we'll just have to see. I mean, it's not exactly the appointment that I would have made. He's a career CIA guy with, I believe, no military experience. You got the CIA run by a military guy, and but what it ought to do anyway is remove a lot of the friction between the Pentagon and the CIA and the Pentagon and the State Department. And maybe against his will, Bush will finally have a team that talks to each other.
All right. I think everybody will be waiting to see, of course, what the outcome of all of this is, and much needs to be decided first, including who controls the Senate. Joe Galloway, thanks a lot for joining us.
Happy to, Warren, anytime.
Also with us, Colonel Thomas Hemmes. He is a retired Marine colonel, served in Iraq in 2004 and helped establish bases for the reconstituted Iraqi Armed Forces. Is Colonel Hemmes with us? I understood that he was. I'm not sure now that I am correct. What is the situation? He is with us.
I'm here.
Colonel, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Here we have you, one of those who has called before the election for the resignation of Defense Secretary Rumsfeld. Now it has happened, and the president wants to nominate Robert Gates, formerly the head of the CIA, to replace him. Has the president made the right choices in both cases?
I unquestionably think he made the right choice in asking Mr. Rumsfeld to leave. Mr. Rumsfeld's done a great deal of service for the country, and the last service was to step down because he lost the credibility that we need for this particular conflict. I don't know about Mr. Gates. I know some about his career, but obviously I don't know him well enough to comment. The key thing is he comes in as a new person with an opportunity to make the changes that are necessary if we're going to turn this around.
And what necessary changes are there?
I think the very first thing he has to do with the Pentagon is put it on a wartime footing. We've been acting as if it's peacetime. We have troops getting ready to go to Iraq today that do not have equipment to train on, and yet our wartime, our repair depots are working 8-hour days, peacetime hours. Why aren't they working wartime hours? I know the Americans working there would be more than happy to do it. The administration has refused to provide the funds to do so. We need to buy the better equipment that our guys need and have needed for 3 years, and yet we've refused to put ourselves on a wartime footing and develop it quickly and get it out there. We need to change our personnel policies. We still are saying commanding U.S. units is most important, and our strategy specifically says the Iraqi army is the only way out, so why aren't our best people going to advise Iraqi units and being rewarded for it? We need to massively increase our support to the Iraqi army. They're still traveling around in open-back pickup trucks.
So you're saying, in other words, you're calling for more of a commitment even that has been made so far in both money and personnel.
Well, certainly in money. I mean, one of the things we've not had is a fair analysis. Those people calling for a phased pullout or whatever they want to call it have not discussed what happens if we do. Do we get the wider Shia-Sunni civil war that rips apart the Middle East, and oh, by the way, that's where a lot of the oil comes from? We may not have, and I don't agree with going into Iraq, but now we're stuck with it. Now we have to figure out how to get out of there with the most stability possible. I think the route of supporting the Iraqi army, which is the one force that seems to be still holding together well, and supporting the Iraqi government is our best shot at doing that. We don't have a lot of time to make that happen. We have made ourselves largely irrelevant due to the bad policies of the past. We have to convince the Iraqis that we are back in the game, we're willing to help them like they need to be helped, and that we are willing to stay for a resolution. Unless we do that, it's going to be lost.
All right. Well, Colonel Hemmes, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Again, retired Marine Colonel, one who called early on for the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld, which has happened today. Uncertain, as we heard a moment ago, about Robert Gates, formerly of the CIA, as the right man to replace him. We'll hear more about that, talk a little bit more about what the Democrats might have to say about the kind of thing that Colonel Hamas is calling for, an increased commitment to the war in Iraq. Once again, the Democrats have won control of the Congress. We'll hear more about later also about Nancy Pelosi and the prospects for a divided government. But first, there's the Senate. Republican Senator George Allen is trailing Democrat James Webb in Virginia. But the vote is so close, there may be a recount. Jeff Shapiro is political reporter for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. And, Jeff, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, how close is it right now?
7,312 votes separate the candidates. That's 7,312 votes to Mr. Webb's good. He is, both candidates collected over a million votes, turnout of about 50%, a lot lighter than we had anticipated, given the national nature of the campaign. As far as a recount is concerned, Mr. Allen is entitled to one. State law provides that privilege when the difference is a half percent or less, and of course that would be at taxpayer expense. However, it is a long and sluggish process and would not begin in earnest until after Thanksgiving. So there's a good deal of speculation here in Virginia right now. Will there be pressure on George Allen to back off on this recount if it does not appear that this result can be reversed?
Why will it take until after Thanksgiving?
These are the intricacies of the Virginia election law. Perhaps you remember them, I think, from your day in Virginia. There is a lengthy period that must pass under which the vote must be certified, recounted, the columns checked, the numbers double-checked, and it will be after the Thanksgiving holiday before a recount could officially commence.
Okay. Let me come back to you in a moment, if I may, Jeff Shapiro of the Richmond Times-Dispatch. We want to go first to Yellowstone Public Radio in Montana and Jackie Yamanaka, who is news director. You've got another very close one there with Senator Conrad Burns being challenged there by John Tester. Tell us exactly what's happening now.
Well, we're waiting because John Tester apparently gave a victory remarks. But Senator Conrad Burns and or his staff have yet to concede or say whether or not they're going to challenge. So I'm just standing here at the hotel waiting to hear the answer to that question.
So what are his options then, Conrad Burns? He could either agree that he's lost or he could challenge. What would that mean in Montana?
Well, that's what we're trying to figure out because apparently he has... According to the unofficial returns, he's lost by over 3,000 votes. We don't know what the final vote tallies are and if there are grounds for a challenge and what that challenge might be.
Okay.
So if he's asking for a recount or if they feel that there was some sort of impropriety in the way the vote was carried out, we don't know.
Jackie Yamanaka, again, news director at Yellowstone Public Radio. We need to take a break. We're going to do that right now. When we come back, we'll hear more about what's happening in the Senate, how crucial it is. We've already determined by the fact that we now have a new Secretary of Defense nominee to be confirmed or otherwise. We'll talk about Nancy Pelosi and other things, too, on To the Point.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. Once again, control of the Senate seems to depend on two seats, one in Virginia, one in Montana. Very quickly, Jackie Yamanaka, I know you're going to off to see if you can find out what Senator Burns has decided to do. If he decides to challenge, how long might it take?
I don't know. It depends on what there if there is one and what they're going to challenge.
So I see. So and this, I take it, is unprecedented in Montana. You haven't had a situation like this before.
Not under these new voting rules, where voters could register to vote and vote on election day. This is brand new for this year. Also, you know, so we don't know if there are provisional ballots. I mean, there's just so many unknowns. Also, you know, voters had to show ID. So they've done that before, so we don't know. We really don't know.
Did you vote by computers in Montana? Did you have these new electronic voting devices?
No. Still paper ballots. Use a pencil. still in the Oval.
Okay. Well, we will see what happens in Montana. Jackie Yamanaka, again, news director at Yellowstone Public Radio. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Sure thing, Warren.
A lot of talk, obviously, about these new registration procedures, about ID, voter ID, about provisional ballots before the election, and much discussion of what might happen if they came to be issues when there was a close race. Tova Wang is Democracy Fellow at the Century Foundation. That's a progressive public policy think tank in New York. Tova Wang, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So this is everybody's worst nightmare, I take it, what's happening in Montana, not the machines so much as these other rules that might be subject to challenge if, in fact, there is a close vote.
Well, and I think it's even more the case in Virginia, given the situation there. It's looking in Montana, and I was not able to hear your previous guest, but it seems in Montana that the vote margin is such that a recount and some kind of legal challenge there is less likely than it is in Virginia. If it does end up that there is a call for a recount and a challenge of some sort in Virginia, that could go on for quite some time. And it's especially likely if Montana has already fallen that there will be this kind of litigation, since it will be determinative of the control of the Senate.
We've already heard from Virginia. Jeff Shapiro of the Richmond Times-Dispatch is still with us. Before, Tova Wang, you came on the show. And what we heard from Montana was that Senator Burns, although he is at the moment behind by about 3,000 votes, has not conceded. His opponent, John Tester, has claimed a victory. But apparently in Montana there were new registration procedures. There's also issues, as there are in so many places, about provisional ballots, and there was also voter ID. So there are a number of areas where a challenge might be launched. Are you aware of other places around the country, Tova Wang, where there were serious problems, but which nobody's talking about because the vote wasn't very close?
Well, yes. I mean, and I'm glad that you brought that up, because you need to look at the country as a whole to sort of determine where the status of our democracy is right now. And there were a lot of problems. Three I would focus on is, first, you again had, as we had in 2004, long lines throughout the country, some of which were not avoidable and some of which were quite avoidable. Some places didn't have enough voting machines and you had people waiting in long lines. And again, this happened particularly in minority neighborhoods. And, you know, for people who have jobs and have to go back to work and have kids they need to take care of, this is tantamount to a violation of their voting rights. Again, as anticipated, we saw tremendous problems with voter identification rules, not just with the rules themselves, but confusion over the rules. You had several sitting elected officials being improperly asked for identification or being asked for identification and not having it and having to go home to get it, which is fine for them since this is their whole life. But for people who have other obligations, they're not going to be able to go home and get ID. We saw this all over the country.
So the question arises then, if these kinds of problems took place, but if there isn't a situation where there is such a close race that there might be a challenge, is it likely that the same kind of problems might crop up again in the next election?
Well, that's right. I mean, if people don't recognize this and everyone sort of after this election says, well, you know, things went really well and everything is fine now, that's really just a symptom of the election not being very close in most places. But in fact, there were still some major problems, and some of these problems were new ones, newly created, such as these new rules regarding voter identification and some of the misguided protocols for implementing the statewide voter registration databases.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, once again, Tova Wang is Democracy Fellow at the Century Foundation. We'll talk to you more in the future about this. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Jeff Shapiro, quickly back to you with the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Are there the kinds of issues in Virginia that we have been hearing about? Might there be not just a recount asked, but also challenges based on registration procedures or provisional ballots or voter ID?
In the immediate run-up to the election, there were reports out of Virginia of the FBI looking into possible voter intimidation, some suspicious telephone calls. There have been some additional complaints overnight. They've been turned over to the federal authorities. There was keen interest in this, of course, because of concern about irregularity of elsewhere around the country, particularly at the presidential level. As far as the actual balloting is concerned, Virginia incrementally has been moving to high tech balloting, largely as a consequence of the Florida experience in 2000. One pre-election glitch was an improperly produced ballot in several localities, Northern Virginia, Charlottesville as well, areas with large Democratic votes, by the way. These ballots did not properly list the name of the Democratic nominee, Jim Webb.
On the other hand, the FBI investigation, as I understood it yesterday from the blogs, was that the intimidation charges were most, and the claims of misleading phone calls telling people to go to the wrong precinct and that sort of thing, were mainly lodged against the Republicans rather than the Democrats. And now it appears the Republicans are the ones that are going to challenge, if anybody is.
I think your account is spot on, but I think this also brings to the public's attention a lot of the gaming and the gamesmanship that is going on within both parties over voter suppression calls and other voter suppression tactics.
All right. Well, we will see, of course, what happens in Virginia, what Senator Allen decides to do, and whether the Democrats might have challenges of their own. Jeff Shapiro, again, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Political reporter for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Once again, the Democrat Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco said again today the Democrats are not about getting even. Impeachment is off the table. She said she'll be the speaker not just of the Democrats, but of the House.
The American people spoke out for a return to civility in the Capitol in Washington and how Congress conducts its work. And Democrats pledge civility and bipartisanship in the conduct of the work here. And we pledged partnerships with the Congress, the Republicans in Congress, and with the president, and not partisanship.
Speaker-elect Nancy Pelosi speaking today in a brief news conference that she had to address reporters after it appeared that she was becoming the speaker-elect of the next Congress. Eleanor Clift is a contributing editor for Newsweek magazine, a student of the Congress, and Nancy Pelosi especially. Always good to have you on our program.
Glad to be with you.
What about it? Is Nancy Pelosi reviled by Republicans leading up to this election as practically the devil incarnate? Is she credible when she says she wants to run her Congress in a bipartisan way?
Oh, I think she is credible because I think she got the message from the voters that this was not necessarily an endorsement of the Democrats. This was a rejection of the Republicans. And if the Democrats govern in the same way as the Republicans, narrow ideologically and autocratically, they'll get their pink slip in 2 years. So I do think that she is serious. She is a very political creature, but she doesn't view the other side as the enemy. I think she thinks you can play a tough political fight, but you can be civil and you can let the other side participate. The Democrats have really been excluded from the process in the House. They haven't been allowed to offer amendments. They've been given bills, minutes before they had to vote on them. And so I think she is determined to change that behavior. And she has a package that she put forward, before the election happened, saying whichever party wins, we need to change the housekeeping of the House. And so I do think she is serious.
Here in California, a lot of smart politicians used to say that nobody could ever get elected statewide from San Francisco. That was Sin City, just under the famous former Speaker of the State Assembly and Treasurer used to say that. Dianne Feinstein, of course, is from San Francisco and is a moderate. But Nancy Pelosi has been associated, particularly by the Republicans, with the most liberal inclinations of that very liberal city. What's her voting record like?
Yeah, I mean, what do we consider sort of out of the ballpark liberal? I mean, she is pro-choice. I suspect she doesn't favor the death penalty. I don't see her doing anything about those social issues in the Congress. On economic issues, she wants to raise the minimum wage. I don't know that that's particularly liberal. We now have 22 states, I believe, that have raised the minimum wage over what the federal minimum wage is. So I think all this, tossing around of the labels is really outdated. And I think that she is not going to go too far left on virtually anything. The Democrats need support from the business community. There's a research and development tax credit that they've got on their 6 for 06. It's one of the things they want to negotiate. They do want to pressure the government to negotiate lower prescription drug prices. Is that liberal? I mean, these are broadly popular things that she is advocating.
What about the fact that they have elected, as in part of her caucus, will be Democrats who, in many cases, sound a lot like Republicans?
Well, I think that's how you get to be a majority party. You got to have a big tent. I think the Republicans are looking at the other side of that problem, and that is they've got a lot of ideological purity, but their numbers are drastically reduced, and they've lost all their moderates. I mean, I think it is a balancing act. She is going to have to satisfy an angry base that has been out in the wilderness for a dozen years and really hates the president and hates the war. And she's got a lot of people who are coming in, new people, who are not necessarily pro-choice. They support gun rights. I think she's going to stay away from those hot-button social issues and really try to do more on the bread-and-butter side where the Democrats can agree.
When you talk about the angry base, will it get even angrier when she says again after the election that impeachment is off the table?
I think most Democrats understand that that's about George Bush, who's going to be gone in 2 years, and that would be misplaced and would, you know, blow up in the Democrats' face, just as the impeachment of Bill Clinton blew up in the Republicans' face. I think there are some people on the fringe, and maybe some of the bloggers who aren't going to like it, but mainstream Democrats are not out there pressing for impeachment.
What do you think they're looking for, and what do they hope for from we presume at the moment at least, from control of at least one house of the Congress?
Well, they want a check on a president who has been behaving like a king, mostly with regard to Iraq. And frankly, the firing of Rumsfeld and the president embracing the likely recommendations of the Baker Commission. This election has already delivered on what the Democrats were asking for and what the people evidently want.
And you think then that Nancy Pelosi will be able comfortably to reflect what you describe as the consensus of voters and to get her caucus to go along?
Comfortably? Look, Democrats fight and argue and debate. I think it's a challenge. But I think Democrats understand that they are on probation for 2 years. And if they don't deliver and don't seem to be governing effectively, they're likely to be defeated in 2 years. A lot of the more culturally conservative members come from districts that were drawn for Republicans. If they want to win, they can't take rigidly liberal positions. I don't even think they believe them or want them. This is a much broader party, and I think that's all to the good for the party and for the country.
Eleanor Clift, as always, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Contributing editor for Newsweek magazine. We're going to take a very brief break, come back and talk a little bit more about what appears to be the beginning of divided government on To the Point from PRI.
For more information about To the Point or to podcast this program, visit kcrw.com and click on KCRW A to Z.
Foreman Olney back with To the Point. Just to review for a moment, an enormous amount of news today with the president announcing that Don Rumsfeld is stepping down and that he has appointed or has nominated Robert Gates, former director of the CIA, to replace him as the Secretary of Defense. We're also hearing, of course, about the new speaker-elect of the Congress, of the new Congress, Nancy Shapiro. Nancy Pelosi of San Francisco. So many names get them confused today. Let's talk a little bit more about what is in store. We also, I should just once again, by way of review, point out, we still don't know what's going to happen in the Senate. It may be that Senator Burns of Montana does concede, which would leave only the Virginia seat up for grabs, but it may well be that there are two of them. In any case, we won't know who's in charge of the Senate probably until things are decided in Virginia, which could be as late as Christmas. Tom Edsel is former senior political reporter at The Washington Post. He's author of a new book called Building Red America, The New Conservative Coalition and the Drive for Permanent Power. He's also a senior correspondent at The New Republic. Tom Edsel, welcome.
How are you?
Very well. What about the drive for permanent power? Has it been stalled?
It's certainly been blocked for the moment. And the real question is whether the Democrats can use this moment, and they do have a moment right now, to actually consolidate their power and build on it, or are they going to do as they basically did in 1993 and 1960? 74, 76, where they had power and then very quickly lost it. Eleanor, I was listening to her talking. I think there is going to be a problem in the House. You have a very liberal committee chairmanship group in the House. Basically, the senior members are far more to the left of the new freshman members. And I think there's going to be considerable tension there in terms of what kind of agenda to push.
What about what Nancy Pelosi said today, that she wants to see herself as Speaker of all the House, not just of the Democrats, that she's reaching out, trying to be nonpartisan with the other side of the aisle in the House and in the White House as well?
I think she will try. She is going to be under pressure from her own district and from those who with whom she is closest in the House, to move somewhat to the left and being leader of the whole House. Plus, the Republican Party is going to go after her with a vengeance. They already did in the during the elections. She was demonized. And I think that they will try to do that again and try to make her into a real flashpoint. How she will deal with that will be very, very interesting to follow, and I don't know, it will be new for her.
Well, what are the structural issues that you write about in your book, Building Red America, the New Conservative Coalition and the Drive for Permanent Power, Tom Edsall, and how are they still in effect, even though the Democrats seem to have done so well on this one occasion?
Well, the Democrats have done very well on this occasion because basically, the Republicans screwed up terribly, especially on the war and the management of the war. All the exit polls show that's the overwhelming issue. The problem structurally for the Democratic Party is that, one, the elite of the Democratic Party, the people who set the agenda, who attend the Democratic conventions, write the platforms, and are real the primary forces behind whether or not to approve or disapprove a Supreme Court nominee, they come from a very socially liberal elite, very much in favor of abortion rights, personal sexual privacy, all things that are perfectly fine to agree with, but they tend to go well to the left on these issues of where the electorate as a whole is. And it's much more on those kinds of issues than on the economic issues where the divide and the conflicts occur within the Democratic Party, and the problems also occur in the general election. We've seen Republicans consistently using what are described as wedge issues, from Willie Horton to gay marriage, not successfully this time, but successfully in the past, and that's been based really on capitalizing on this inclination by the Democratic dominant elite group, which is not the numerically dominant group, but it is the agenda-setting group.
All right, Tom Edsall, once again, Building Red America, also a senior correspondent at the New Republic. Come back to you in a moment. First, Tom Schaller is with us. He's an associate professor of political science at the University of Maryland and author of another new book, Whistling Past Dixie, How Democrats Can Win Without the South. Professor, good to have you with us.
Hey, Warren, how are you?
Good. How can they win it without the South? They had, of course, the solid South for many years. Now it's turned Republican.
Yeah, well, they did last night, if you pay attention. Five of the six governors they picked up outside the South. Five of the six Senate seats, assuming that Webb wins, will be outside the South. And 24 of the 28 House seats so far that have been confirmed are outside the South. And you know what? For the first time since the 1953-54 83rd Congress, 52-year period, the minority party in the South, which is the Democrats, will be the majority party in the Congress. And I haven't heard of a single national commentator to note this very dramatic transformation. And if Webb holds on, will give Democrats five seats out of 22 in the 11 Confederate states, but the Democrats will be the minority in the Senate, and yet they will be, they'll be the minority party in the South, and yet they'll be the majority party in the Senate. And that basically hasn't happened since 1953-54, except for a brief period in 1985-86. So for the first time in basically a half a century, the Southern party is now the minority party.
Why is that so important?
Well, it's not necessarily very important, but since the Southern Party and the Southern wing of the Republican Party has been ascendant, and I think they've changed and transformed politics and policy in the country in a fundamental way, steadily but surely over the last 4 years, and particularly the last 6 years with a Republican Southern conservative president in the White House, the results are in some sense of a rebuke of that transformation.
What do you say to Tom Schaller's suggestion, and excuse me, to Tom Edsel's suggestion, and I'll get him to elaborate on it a bit again, that the Democrats may have done okay today, but as Eleanor Clift put it, this was really a rejection of the Republicans rather than an embrace of the Democrats, and Tom Edsel would be implying, I think, that the Democrats may not be able to hang on very long.
Well, I mean, I think that remains to be seen, and I've debated Tom, actually, as he knows, about this subject, and I would point out that I still think the media narrative on the 2004 election is wrong. President Bush and the Republicans controlled the entire apparatus of the national government, were told by every pundit that they had the better strategic, tactical, rhetorical, and financial advantages, and they had something that no president since FDR had in 1929, which was a realigning powerful issue in American politics, plane into building, plane into Pentagon, plane into Shanksville, broadcast live on television. And what was the result of that election? The result of that election is George Bush picked up 3 points, and basically Iowa, because New Mexico and New Hampshire canceled each other out. And his 3-point increase was the smallest increase for a reelected president since 1900. They gained 3 seats in the House, 4 in the Senate, no governors, and they lost the state legislatures. Now look at the results here today. 6 seats in the House, 6 seats in the Senate, 6 governors, and 28 House members. The election of this cycle is a far greater magnitude, with supposedly the Democrats having far fewer internal resource advantages compared to the Republicans. So I'm not really sure that that narrative is right.
Tom Schaller with the University of Maryland. Tom Edsel, back to you at the New Republic. Is this then, in some sense, a bigger victory for the Democrats than 2004 was for the Republicans?
Yes, I think that's clear. The question is more, is this a bigger victory for the Democrats than 1994 was for the Republicans?
That's when they took over the Congress for the first time in 40 years. Go ahead.
Yes. I actually think Tom Schaller has got some very good points, and I think his argument about the Mountain West, is, which he hasn't explored yet, has got a lot of validity. And I've just written a piece for the New Republic supporting some of that argument. But I think that the Democrats have done well. But if you look at the polls, it is without the war issue, which was, and the Iraq war was not an issue that you could call a realigning kind of issue in the same sense that the Depression, or this is an act by the Republican leadership that was just not acceptable to a lot of voters, but it didn't fit the ideology of the Republican Party, of conservatism, or anything like that. And then the whole Abramoff scandals were really a violation of Republican, and for that matter, Democratic principles. Mm-hmm. To call this yet a clear Democratic win, I think, is premature. I think there is the potential, but there's a long struggle for the Democrats to reach that point.
Tom Schaller, back to you. What about the Mountain West? We were hearing already about Montana, and what sort of a new dynamic is represented there?
Well, I think what you're seeing is Democrats are doing better, and what really happened yesterday was what I'm calling a Rust Belt realignment, where you see Democrats running, and I wish Eleanor Clift were still on the phone because I think she's wrong, running to the left of moderate Republicans and beating them. The great irony of this election is that the Southern conservative wing of the party, for the most part, will go untouched, but the moderate Republicans of the Ford and Rockefeller ilk are the ones whose oxes will be gored. Just look at the Republicans that lost. The National Journal ranks people based on their ideological moorings, and of the top 30 most liberal Republicans, Jim Leach, Iowa, loses. Nancy Johnson, number 3. Most liberal Republican. Charlie Bass, New Hampshire. Kurt Weldon, Pennsylvania, 20th most liberal. Colby's seat replaced, 21st most liberal. Sue Kelly, 27th in New York. Jeb Bradley, New Hampshire. So 6 of the top 30 most liberal Republicans lost yesterday, and they lost because the candidates running against them were uniformly anti-war. In fact, do you realize that of the 58 Democrats running in the most competitive House races, all but 9 of them were pro-choice, Every single one of them was against privatizing Social Security. Every single one of them.
Yeah, but if I can interrupt you, I'm sorry to do that because we're just running out of time. But isn't the point about the Mountain West in part that Democrats have adopted some conservative ideas, particularly having to do with guns and others of the social issues that have been important to Republicans?
I mean, in my book, I advocate the Democrats taking the Second Amendment off the table so they can talk about other issues. So I'm fine with that. But unfortunately, I think what we're hearing is Keith Schuler won and Jim Webb won, and so Democrats won because they caved on pro-choice positions and because they're pro-gun. And that is just not empirically correct in terms of what happened yesterday. What happened was liberal to progressive Democrats beat moderate Republicans in the Northeast and Midwest, and that is why Speaker Pelosi is now the Speaker, not because conservative Democrats beat arch-conservative Republicans. That's just a fiction.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. Tom Schaller at University of Maryland, Whistling Past Dixie, How Democrats Can Win Without the South. Tom Edsel at the New Republic, Building Red America, the New Conservative Coalition and the Drive for Permanent Power. Today's program produced by Katie Cooper, Karen Ranziner, and Vanessa Romo. Our technical director, Mike Newport. Phoebe Zimmerman. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.